Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink here on heritageradionetwork.org. This is the show that brings you all the things that are delicious to drink and the people who bring them to you. My name is Joe Campanelli. I'm the host of the show and also the beverage director of Del Anima, Lartuzzi, Anfora, and the recently opened La Picho restaurant down in downtown New York City. I have a very special guest here today. I'm really excited. We have on Megan Krigbaum. Megan's the senior editor for Food and Wine magazine. She's a local Brooklynite, and according to her her Twitter profile, she is a fan of Bubbles, Baked Alaska, and Surprise Excursion. So here's Megan. Megan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So fun to be here.
Really, really excited to have you on. I guess Food and Wine magazine is kind of the most important food and wine magazine out there right now. So it's really an honor to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about what your role is and how you work with the great Ray Isle at Food and Wine?
Yeah, sure. No, I'm so lucky to work with Ray Isle. He's our executive wine editor. And he travels the world and I stay at the office and write wine pairings and do a lot of stuff more based in New York, hanging out with winemakers that come into town and doing tons and tons of tastings. In our tasting room, we have a tasting room that's just full of thousands and thousands and thousands of bottles of wine. We get maybe like 12 cases, so 150 or so bottles a week that come in unsolicited into our office. And so we have to deal with them somehow, and I end up tasting a good majority of those.
Wow. How many wines a week would you say you're able to taste?
Well, the thing is, I try to taste no less than 60 bottles a week, which is tricky in an 8-hour workday. But then that leaves, you know, like 90 bottles that are still hanging out, just waiting to be tasted every week. So it's a pretty intense tasting room right now. A little overwhelming.
Okay, so you're saying you're not traveling the world on a private jet?
No, not at all.
Yeah, you know, fancy winemakers bringing you to Chateau Yquem and all
I
of
wish,
that.
No, 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 they come to us. That's the great part of New York. They're always here. There are always tastings every week, but then winemakers are constantly in our tasting room. So I can meet people from Chile, from Austria, from France, from Italy, all in one week, which is really cool.
Yeah, people always ask me at the restaurants, like, how do you find the wines? Do you go travel to every vineyard? And I wish that was the case, but it's terribly inefficient.
I know.
Right? I would wish I can't go to visit. So we taste with our distributors every week, and that's kind of how.
Right.
But I guess what I'm curious about is the samples that you get that are delivered to you, that can't possibly be like the smallest craft producer who makes 1,000 bottles a year.
Right.
Can it?
Well, it's interesting. Sometimes we get them. I mean, sometimes we'll get wines that are all completely allocated from really small wineries in California. And those are really hard to write about because none of our readers can get them. And we have millions of readers. And then sometimes we get big brands. And then sometimes we call in the smaller producers. So if we're working on a story, I just did a story about champagne from the Aube region, very small producers there. I called in bottles from different distributors and importers around the U.S.
And they were apt to give it to you?
Some. Mm-hmm. Some were, and some said, I only get, you know, 3 cases of this a year, and I can't give any of it up. I have to give it to restaurants. So then we don't get to taste it.
You know, a lot of people in the wine industry talk about the influence of very influential wine journalists, especially people who write very critically about wine. Do you think that there's a responsibility, or what is the responsibility of a journalist to when you're talking about wine?
Well, there's certainly a place for wine criticism, and I am grateful that I'm not I'm not that sort of journalist. I think there is so much good wine right now, especially coming to the United States. Like our opportunity to drink well every single day is just vast. It's growing and getting better and better. And so I have plenty to write about that's good, and I don't need to write about the bad stuff or criticize any of it. But there's certainly, for a lot of people who are collectors, those are really important. Those scores are really important to them. So, and that's for a different audience, I think.
Okay. And but your magazine has consciously stayed away from the scores.
We do. We do stay away from the scores. We suggest bottles that we really love instead.
Yeah. Why do you think that the score, other outside of the critical realm, do you find that scores are something that are useful when talking about wine?
I think they give benchmarks, and they certainly look at vintages in a specific way, to look at a track record. I don't know how much influence they have on me as a wine drinker or on the average wine drinker, but again, for people who are collecting or people who are really concerned about rankings, then it's great for them.
Yeah, I could completely see that as being a useful collecting tool when you want to resell a wine. But
right, it's great for auctions.
I was at
the Christie's auction for Charlie Trotter's big portfolio from his restaurant last week, and they were constantly talking about what the ratings were for all those bottles that he had, and it seemed really important to the people who were there. So.
That's right. They have the El Bulli auction is coming
up. Sotheby's, I know. It'd be fun.
That's super exciting, especially their bottles from great producers that were made specifically for El Bulli.
Right.
That just don't exist anywhere else that are going to be up for sale. So.
Right. At this Charlie Trotter's one, they were auctioning off 6 Riedel glasses that had been made just for Trotter. And I don't remember exactly how many liters they held, but it almost could have held an entire bottle of wine in one of these glasses. Oh, and it went for $10,000 for 6 of these glasses.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. The glasses that we have at the restaurants are 24 ounces, which, right. which almost holds which a huge. Bottle is 25.4 right. ounces. But the idea is that we only fill it up like a quarter of the way. So you have lots of nice swirl room, but
right. Yeah,
I can't imagine
huge.
A liter.
Right. Where do you, do you even have a shelf for that? I don't know where it goes. I don't know.
I guess if you can afford $10,000 worth of glasses, you can buy some big shelves too.
I guess so.
That's enormous. So I'd love to find out a little bit more about how you got into wine. When did this start? Was there a bottle that was very influential for you, or a life moment, or has this been a gradual process?
It's been pretty gradual. I grew up in Michigan in a family that certainly did not drink a lot. Like they would have a bottle of wine occasionally. My mom really loves sweet red wines and sweet white wines. We spent my childhood visiting wineries in northern Michigan, which at the time weren't nearly as good as they are now. And I just remember doing that with them, but it wasn't like we had a cellar. It was not a super important part of their lives. So when I went to college in Holland, Michigan, I was working at this restaurant called Butch's Dry Dock, and Butch, who owns the restaurant, loves French wine, just a total francophile, and had a huge wine list, I think like 700 bottles of wines. And so everything that he opened, he was really insistent that everybody try. And it was just this total shocking and revelationary moment for me of like, oh my gosh, there's all this stuff that I don't know anything about. And he started throwing books at me and Wine Spectator at me, and I just got totally hooked on it and knew that I really wanted to do that. So then I went to another college in Vermont, and after I graduated from Bennington, I went to California and worked at a winery in Napa just to kind of get a sense of the pacing of what happens with growing a vine and how wine's made and what a tasting room works like and all of that scene. Then moved back to New York.
So you knew you wanted to be a wine professional before a journalist, or a journalist first?
A journalist first. I've been a writer all my life. I love writing. And it was really cool to find something that was so precise to write about, but then also so vast. And I really, my biggest interest in wine comes from the family winemakers and the places where wine is made and grown. I'm really obsessed with rocks these days, trying to like collect little pieces of soil from all around the world. Because I just, if I can't be there, I can at least like feel the rock and like see what that looks like. So, it's cool. It's really cool.
So where are some of the more interesting rocks? I was hesitant to ask this question, but since you're so interested in it.
I love them. A couple of years I got to go to Sicily for a story, which was really amazing. And constantly in the wine world, we're talking about terroir and talking about volcanic soils. And I was on Mount Etna, which is still an active volcano in the northeastern part of Sicily. And the soil there is so insane. You can pick up chunks of lava stone that they almost look like softballs. They're huge pieces of rock, and you can see where the volcanoes erupted and taken out the roads or taken out the vineyards or homes or things. And it's black and it's thick, and there's only a couple of plants that can grow through that soil and kind of turn it over organically, but that takes hundreds and hundreds of years to change. So that was really impressive to me.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah,
and yeah, I know you've also been to Santorini, haven't you?
Oh, I haven't been to Santorini.
You haven't? You
no,
wrote
I
about Santorini.
To Santorini so all right, bad.
That's one of those. See, I picture the senior editor of Food and Wine again traveling all over the world.
I know,
but
I
I've read a piece of yours on Santorini.
Yes, yeah,
and
yeah.
Santorini has some really interesting rocks. It's also volcanic soil, but it's a combination of that dark black volcanic ash, and then you have these big like. Pumice stones.
Yeah,
they look like it, like, and then like a little boulder, but you could throw it at someone and hit them, and it
right.
wouldn't hurt because it's so light.
Because it's
airy.
So light, so weird.
It's
no.
completely fascinating.
Yeah, and I met with a guy from Fox Run Winery in the Finger Lakes last week, and he was talking about all the fossils they found because they're basically in an old, I think he called a Paleolithic Delta, and so there are all these weird little. Fossils that he's found there that have just kind of turned up in the vineyard, which is really crazy. It's really
wow. So other than the physiological influence that something like a black soil versus a white soil, do you think that you're able to actually translate flavors of the soil into the wine?
I'm skeptically trying to figure that out. I think it's certainly possible to detect minerality of different levels in wine. I think I have to taste a lot more to know if I'm tasting black soil or white soil or slate or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's kind of a big debate, and the romantic in me wants
right.
to say, yes, absolutely, for sure. But I know that it's hard to be proven.
Right.
But I think that also a lot of it has to deal with the local culture. The soil is part of the people who live there, and I think if you're living on a volcano and there's eruptions and there's ash flying around, you might get some ash on your grapes, or you might have a chimney in your house or whatever it is. You might get some smoking character,
right?
Just like if you're living by the sea, and you might get some brininess from
that sea mist, or right eucalyptus. If you're by the eucalyptus tree, you might get a little bit of that oil into your wine. Mm-hmm. All of it. Yeah.
Okay, so we've established that you're not flying all over the world, but if you could fly, where would you go? Where's your top wine destination you've never been to?
I really want to go to Vienna right now. I'm really attracted to those wines. For the reds and the whites from Austria are really amazing, and I think they go so well with food. They're just so bright and so fresh and peppery in both reds and whites, and I think they're just amazing. So I'd really like to go there.
I'd love to go there too. And that's so interesting that you say that Vienna is it's one of the few places where I say, which wine region do you want to go to? And say Vienna. Well, Vienna is a big city, but it's actually a city in the middle of wine area of Austria.
Right, it looks so places. Amazing. I know.
Yeah, we just did a Red Wines of Austria producer night at Anfora.
Cool. Who did you have?
We had Moritz.
Yes.
And Nittnaus, and had some really great stuff.
Yeah,
some Saint
really
Laurent and Blaufränkisch.
Right, and the Zweigelts that are so amazing.
Zweigelts.
Right.
Which, happy birthday, Zweigelt. It's 90 years since
really?
Zweigelt has
that.
Been crossed and been made. So those red wines of Austria, I think, it was a surprise for me. I've liked those producers in the past, but we were able to pour 6 or 7 different ones that were all unique and truly delicious.
Right. They're sort of in that same vein of red wines from northern Italy, I think, too, the Lagrines and the Pinot Neros that come from there, and that same really, really fresh, really acidic, minerally great food wines. I love them. They're so good.
They're so good. All right, so we are going to take just a quick break here on In the Drink. We'll be back shortly with Megan Krigbaum, senior editor from Food and Wine.
You're listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Wow, I'm hungry for some Surrey Farms pork. I don't know what it is. Anyway, we're back on In the Drink. I'm Joe Campanelli here with Megan Krigbaum, senior wine editor for Food and Wine Magazine. Megan, now that I have pork on my brain, let's do a little food pairing question. Let's do an all pork food pairing.
All pork. All right.
Let's do that.
Let's see.
Let's do what would you pair with a very simple prosciutto, not smoked, just straightforward but good stuff.
Fino sherry. I think Fino sherry, it's so briny and salty too. It cuts right through all that fat. It's delicious.
Wow, Fino sherry is like that recurring theme on this show. Everyone who knows wine, who I like, maybe I like people who like Fino sherry, yeah. I guess.
It's sherry on the mind right now too. Everyone's talking about sherry. Like the new sherry book from Peter Liam, Sherry Fest was just here. Sherry is hot.
Sherry's right hot. And now we have great producer Fernando de Castilla. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yeah, yeah.
They were not imported to the States. It was something that only like Peter Liam would go there and bring a couple bottles back, and you know, or your enthusiast friend would. It was really hard to get, and now finally imported to the States from Bowler Wine. So
really exciting,
really good stuff. Okay, what about an American lightly smoked and cured ham?
I'm really about Grenache these days. I think that juicy sort of in your face, like ebullient fruity Grenache goes really well with sort of the fatty smokiness of ham.
Yes. And would you go with a New World Grenache and an Old World Grenache?
Well, I love all Grenache from the Rhone region, but I think a New World Grenache might be kind of nice. Like maybe something from Southern California might be perfect with that.
Yes. Yeah. I like the Ridge Lightened Springs Grenache.
That's so good. The Unti Grenache from Sonoma. So good. They're making such good stuff.
Okay. How about the very American Thanksgiving's on my mind. So the honey baked ham.
Honey baked. Riesling, right? It's like a really, really bright, fresh Riesling, and it wouldn't even need to have. You could do something like a Spätlese or something with a little bit of sugar, but I think Riesling's perfect with that fatty, sweet ham.
I think that's. I can't elaborate on that anymore. this is the end of the year, right? We have holiday parties coming out. There's always some sort of interesting wine gadget. I'm sure that people send you gadgets all the time. I'm more of a traditionalist. I really love my like waiter style $10 cork pull corkscrew, and a decanter, and that's about it. But I'm sure you come across some pretty cool things. Is there something that you're very excited about?
We get so many of those aerator things in these days. And we've tried them. I don't think they do. We've tried them, and I just don't think that they work very well. Maybe we need to test some more or have some older bottles around or something. I don't know. What I've been really excited about, and this is so stupid, little sparkling wine caps. So that they actually stay on now, so that you can close a bottle of sparkling wine and it keeps all of its fizz between drinks, and you don't have to worry about it. You could keep it overnight, but I never leave a bottle of sparkling wine overnight. But they're really amazing. They're so good. They just have these little arms that flip over the top, and they keep your bottle fizzy. It's
great. That's fantastic. That's so useful.
Yeah, it's good.
That's so useful. The sparkling wine does keep overnight. I have done that.
Yeah. There's that old trick about the spoon. I've never tried that. Does
never
it work?
Tried that either.
Oh.
No. I'm afraid. I don't want to put a metal spoon in my...
I know. Overnight. In your wine.
What wine regions are you particularly excited about right now?
I just had a bottle of Wind Gap Trousseau Gris a couple weeks ago, and I'm really excited about that Petaluma Gap. I'm so curious to see what will come out of there. It's such a small region, so it's probably not going to get huge for us, but I'm really excited about that. I'm really excited about Cava. I love Reventos Cava so much, and they just decided to not be within the Cava DOC anymore. They're going to go and do their own thing now, but I think that they make beautiful wines that can rival a lot of really great sparkling wine regions there.
Yes, I think that's really kind of huge news, though. Yeah. I mean, they're an emblematic, one of the great producers of Cava, and they decided to stop labeling their wines Cava. It's probably when like Montevertine decided to not make Chianti anymore. I don't know if it was as important at the time, but yeah, they're really, I think, an emblematic producer. We poured them at Anfora before. I just love those wines. Do you think that's going to have any ramifications on the industry and all, or do you think the industry of Cava is just so big that they're
it's so big, it might not matter. But it'll certainly make a name for Reventos even more than it already has, I think. Like a really standalone, excellent producer of Cava wines. That neat rosé that they make is so good. It's just delicious.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it's so
incredible.
Good.
So we have Sherry, Cava. Let's give us one more.
Let's
How about
see.
A red
I
wine?
I think Santa Barbara and their Pinot Noirs are pretty exciting. I think California is kind of in this big flux where even in Napa Valley, producers are looking at organics and biodynamics in a way that they've never thought of before. I think that maybe California producers are getting more interested in where they're growing their grapes and what grapes they're growing in different areas, experimenting more with grapes that we haven't seen before, like grapes from the Jura. So random to be bringing grapevines in from the Jura that no one's heard of before and planting them in the Anderson Valley. But Guthrie's doing that with Copain. And it's exciting. I think California
and
is
the Arno Roberts
Trousseau
as
yeah,
well.
They're
is
doing
like
that too.
One of the most beautiful wines.
Gorgeous. Gorgeous. It's a good time for California wine, I think. I think they have an opportunity to make something new, to kind of revolutionize that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the impetus behind our list at La Picho, actually. I'm finding those wines like the Wells Guthrie, the Copain Trousseau, the Arno Roberts, the Wind Gap wines, Lyoko, Brock Cellars. There's so many right now who are making these balanced wines.
Right. It seems like that's happening a little bit in Oregon and Washington, too. There seem to be some winemakers there who are really excited to try something different. It's exciting. It's really good.
Do you think that this is kind of the wave of the future? Do you see people's tastes shifting, or will there always be both?
Well, it's interesting. I live in this world where I'm constantly looking for affordable wines because, again, our readership is so it's so diverse in that there are new drinkers and wine drinkers that have been drinking for years and know what they like. But everyone's looking for a really affordable bottle of wine these days. And it's getting harder and harder to find an affordable bottle of wine from the United States, certainly, but in general, because things are getting so expensive. So I hope that also in the spirit of experimentation, we can find a way to make it so that everyone has access to these wines and not just the sort of more upper crust or the people with money for that.
Yeah, everyone has access to a wine that has integrity and is well made. It isn't just
Right. Not just a big mass produced wine.
Yeah. Now, it would be great if we can. That's the one thing that's missing, I think, between our culture and the European culture, where the wine is on the table the same way that you might have bread or olive oil or water or anything like that. It's just a normal part of the meal. But here, since so much wine is so expensive and it's so rare and a lot of us didn't grow up with it, it seems like such a rare and celebratory thing that until we can get the prices lower and people feel more comfortable with it, it will always be that kind of other separate thing.
Right, and sort of scary. I mean, every time you take $20 out of your wallet, you do think, like, what am I doing with this $20 right now? Am I buying a $6 cup of coffee? Am I buying a $15 bottle of wine? And how far is that going to take me? So I think we have to be really conscious of that.
So would you agree with the statement that European wines in general offer better values?
Right now they do. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, again, we put a little yellow dot next to the wines a purple dot next to the wines that cost $15 or less in the magazine on our wine table of contents. It's getting harder and harder to find good wines for under $15, even from Europe. The wine prices are just going up. And I don't know if that has to do with taxes or, you know, the financial situation that's happening in so much of Europe, but it's kind of a bummer to not be able to have access to that. And I always think about my favorite wine bar in Paris, the Baron Rouge, and they have these huge barrels of wine just sitting there, and you just go over and you fill up your bottle of wine and it ends up costing you €9 or something like so perfect. And you just take it home and you drink it that night for dinner. And then the next day you take it back and you drink it that night for dinner. And it's just like this great way of thinking about wine and not without having to totally burn through all of your money for the week. So,
wow. Really cool. Okay. So if you were to splurge,
yes.
Where would you splurge on?
I think champagne. Mm-hmm. I love champagne so much. I would totally, if I had infinite money, I would take that and spend it all around. I think the Dozenon and Lepage champagne from the Aube is really delicious. They make a gorgeous rosé. And actually, it's not even that expensive, so maybe I'd buy two.
And is that the Aube and Champagne, is that an area, a part of Champagne that you're particularly interested in?
Well, that's another area that's really kind of hot and newsy right now, mm-hmm. because the wine growers are now finally making their own wine rather than selling all their grapes away, and it's really delicious. So I've been drinking more of that lately, so I guess it's on my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then another very sad piece of news. We just heard recently that Mr. Gianfranco Soldera was vandalized in the middle of the night. He's, I think, the greatest producer in Brunello di Montalcino. And it looks like vandals had come in during the night. And, you know, when you're in Tuscany, there's no fences, right? There's no electrical fences or alarm systems. So it looks like some guys just came in during the night and emptied out all of his wine from 2007 to 2012.
Right. 5 years of amazing Brunello. It's heartbreaking. It's awful.
It's just a really awful piece of news.
Yeah.
And it kind of just highlights like the kind of work that a lot of these winemakers have to do. You think about it, the wine is something that you make all year long. It's not it doesn't happen overnight.
Right. Even our little winery even Red Hook Winery that just lost so much of its production from the past 3 years in Hurricane Sandy. I mean, all that work that went into it just kind of vanishes all at once, which is just really so sad.
Yeah. So I really appreciate that part of what you do as a journalist is kind of celebrate the things you're excited about and not poo-poo the things that you're not. But just in that context, like the kind of work that these winemakers do and the winemakers that we get excited about are people who really do work really hard all year long. And it's a labor of love, but of also of blood, sweat, and tears. And and at the end of the day, it's just a ton of work, and to be more of a champion, I think, is very admirable.
Yeah. I think so too.
All right, we're going to do just a very quick rapid fire before you leave. I know. I mean, you get to taste so many wines all the time, so it's just really exciting for me to be able to pick your brain.
Yeah.
But once in a while, we like to do a rapid fire here where we give people kind of obscure wine tasting scenarios and say, what would you taste in this scenario?
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
I think I have an idea what the answer is gonna be. It's gonna be champagne first. Okay. You're
That's not fair. You just predicted my answer.
I predicted your answer. Well, okay, so you are on a private jet to Vienna.
Nice. I like where this is going.
To go wine tasting.
Yes. What would I drink on the private jet? You can't drink Austrian wine, right? Oh, Joe, I would drink champagne. How can you be on a private jet and not drink champagne? I don't know.
All right. I think that's fair enough. How about you're eating pizza at your favorite local Brooklyn haunt? You live in Carroll Gardens, right?
I do.
So maybe at Lucali's, the BYO.
Yeah. Probably beer. I don't know. I think beer and pizza is really awesome. I mean, wine and pizza is delicious too. But my parents were just in from Michigan. They just brought us a 6-pack of my favorite beer in the whole world, which is Two Hearted from Bell's Brewery. I would take that.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. And then you're back at work. You have 1,000 samples. And you're like, I really need to taste through a bunch of these, but I like this one, so I want to taste through that one.
What would you start with?
Yeah, what would you start?
I think I would go to Northern Italy and start tasting through whites from the Alto Adige. I love Müller-Thurgau so much, and I would probably start there.
That's awesome. All right, Megan Craigbaum, thank you so much. Everyone at home, please do check out Food & Wine Magazine and see Megan's coverage. It's really some of the best out there, and she's also just a fantastic person. Please tune in as well every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on In the Drink for more on Heritage Radio Network. .org.
Thanks a lot. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.